Hi, Charisse here with a special announcement. You can now enjoy select episodes of Detailed in video form. That's right. Detailed is now available on RCAT's YouTube channel. Now, you may be thinking, I already listened to the podcast. No need to watch it on YouTube. Well, trust me, if you don't want to miss out, even if you're an avid listener of the podcast, the video format is a completely different experience. Not only is it like hanging out with us, but you also get to hear parts of the conversation that were left on the cutting room floor. You can also see the photos, drawings, and video as we discuss the incredible projects that are featured. Come join us on YouTube. Follow the link in our show notes, and let's get into the details. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
Finding that advocate on a project is always so important, I think, to the success. So all the problems, does something not line up when you're pouring it? All those things, they kind of go away if you have an advocate on the client side that's demanding a good building.
I agree with that. You know, the in this case, Dean Bailey, he was there at every turn of this project, and that's critical because all these wonderful things that we talk about, they will not happen unless there is, you know, ultimately it's the client that needs to help us realize all of this or leads the realization of something like this.
This is Detailed. An original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guests today are Ted Hyman, partner, and Vlad Pykish, partner from ZGF Architects, a firm with multiple offices across North America and 750-plus staff. Ted is a cyclist in every sense of the word, from measuring a project's performance over its life cycle to commuting daily from Long Beach to Los Angeles via bicycle. That's quite the trek. Ted continually strives to reduce carbon emissions in the atmosphere. As ZGF's former managing partner, he leads with this essential question: how can we accelerate the evolution of the sustainably built environment? A fierce advocate for halting climate change in its tracks, Ted works across all project typologies to ensure that architects heal rather than damage the earth. Vlad knows the principles of great design are translatable. Having lived and worked around the globe, Vlad designed projects in Europe and Asia before moving to the Pacific Northwest. Here, he finds inspiration in Portland's livability and strong connection to nature, and enjoys a new opportunity to walk past local projects on his lunch break. Vlad is passionate about advancing design dialogue within ZGF and the community and values the role of critique in the design process. He brings a rigorous approach to his multi-office teams, regularly working across the firm's multiple offices and lecturing at universities. The project we will be talking about today is the William and Linda Frost Center for Research and Innovation at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click in the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Located within the vibrant campus of Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, the William and Linda Frost Center for Research and Innovation exemplifies the university's educational philosophy: learn by doing. This cutting-edge facility represents a bold departure from traditional departmentalization. embodying the growing trend in higher education toward interdisciplinary collaboration, thereby enhancing workforce readiness.
It's a really interesting project because, you know, if you ask Phil Bailey, who was the dean and raised a lot of the money, you know, he thought about this project over 30 years ago when he was, you know, just teaching, you know, he was on the faculty at Cal Poly. And it started really, the foundation was the building next door that we had done, which is the Baker Center. We finished about 10 years ago now, I think. And it was really built to replace the Spider Building, which was at the center of the campus, had been there for, you know, I think 70 years. You know, it was the building for all the sciences. And the idea was to tear it down, tear half of it down, build a new education building, tear the rest of it down, create a new heart to the campus. Instead, what happened after we built the new building, instead of tearing it down, all the faculty moved in there and used it for research space because the campus had no, you know, purpose-built research space on the campus. So coming out of that, hopefully we're going to get that building torn down eventually. This idea to build a new building that was really focused on research came out across the way. And it was really three colleges, that, you know, the College of Science and Math, the College of Agriculture, and Liberal Arts. And probably the best thing that could happen is none of those three colleges had enough money to build a big building on their own. And so they had to pull their resources together to build this building. And that's kind of how it started.
That's an interesting mix.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting mix, but it's really, I think that's where, in some ways, that's where science is going in general. I mean, this idea that STEM education really needs to include the arts to be successful. And here, because the liberal arts program, you know, happened to have a small program that could go into this building, it's doing exactly the kinds of things that should be happening more across the country. And so it was really putting lots of different students together, different faculty together that sometimes, you know, probably wouldn't have talked to each other. And we talk about buildings like the science buildings, research buildings, as places where the architecture, if it's really working great, is causing intellectual collisions to happen. People that wouldn't normally talk to each other all of a sudden running into each other. We had a client who suggested we put really bad elevators in the building because that was the only way they were going to get people to stand still and talk to each other for, you know, 4 or 5 minutes when the elevator broke down. But it's how do you create those kinds of spaces? We had these three deans. Sometimes the schools or the colleges compete for funding, they compete for students, and they absolutely compete for space. So putting them all together in one building was a bit of an experiment in its of itself. And one of the very first things we did was we took the three colleges and the programs each one of them had, and we kind of did a spaghetti map showing where there were collaborations, talking to faculty and students that were collaborating both within the colleges, but then across the colleges. And it was kind of surprising for certainly for us, but probably even more so for the deans, at how much collaboration was already going on between the faculty of those places. And so doing a building that really reinforced that and fostered more collaboration was really important. And then the last thing was really something we talk about a lot, this idea of putting science on display, that not only the students working in the laboratories and the faculty get to see what they're doing, but we wanted any student who comes into the building, and in fact, any student who walks by outside the building, to see science going on. And Dean Bailey's, you know, initial idea was we could measure success if an architect or somebody in the sports comes into that atrium and decides to change majors and become an engineer or a scientist. That's what success was going to be.
As the first interdisciplinary building on campus, the project site selection was driven by the diverse content encapsulated within its walls. It is a centralized hub drawing together undergraduate researchers from an array of disciplines.
It's interesting because the way we went about the building was sort of sketching out what's on the inside of the building. You know, what's the content? and then placing that on this given location, because the location is at the very center of the campus. So it's, you know, it's kind of centrally located. It's right across the street from another science building that ZGF completed a few years ago. So we're given the site and what goes in there, and the two didn't really fit. It's a difficult site. There are existing buildings, you know, there's slope, there's this beautiful old tree. But, you know, once you start putting these things, it's kind of difficult to fit it in. And that's a little bit where we start testing this idea of, you know, if you go around campuses and you go to the engineering part of the campus, usually these buildings are big boxes, walls, not very friendly, not very exciting buildings, and they're just kind of sit there. You know, and clearly something like that simply wouldn't fit on our site. So we had to come up with a different idea, which was to start breaking it up a little bit, figuring out what's really on the inside, and then how do we create these like little volumes. They're very functional, they're very rational, but they allow us to sort of fit in this building in a more kind of organic. We use the metaphor of an Italian hill town, you know, kind of like a little thing that's made out of parts and it's broken up and you walk around it. So that's kind of how the main idea came about, so that it sort of fits in what's already there. It's not like this massive thing, but somehow it's more organic, more part of the place. You know, there's this main walkway where the students are coming by. So what Ted was saying earlier, the idea of the building having this transparency, so as the students are walking by, they can see inside. See the scientists. It's a site feature. You know, it's a building that's, you know, featuring science on display. There's a connection through the building with this kind of bridge element up on top. So that's where the form really comes into place, because once you break the box, you can kind of be a little more intentional about, you know, responding. We have one courtyard, there's a little terrace. And that was very important because, you know, San Luis Obispo is such a beautiful place. You know, it's like sunny, it's warm. And you want to take advantage of those exterior spaces, and you want to kind of bring people closer to the building because it's a nice place to be. And then once they're there, you know, they get to see what's going on. And again, going back to what Ted was saying, is this sort of more interdisciplinary, and also looking at science as something that it's approachable, you know, that it's inclusive, that it's not like, again, big box, lots of glass and stuff, but it's just something that engages people on everyday level.
Over 1,500 students converge within its innovative walls each year, spanning biology, biomedical engineering, chemistry, computer science, physics, biological oceanography, food science, and audiovisual communication. The center cultivates an atmosphere where collaboration thrives. And the building spaces are a tangible reflection of this dynamic cross-pollination of expertise.
The realization was that if you really look at these science buildings, they tend to be very big. But actually, in terms of how you organize a building, I don't know, residential building is made out of apartments. You can think of a science building, we call in little neighborhoods, and they're of a certain size, whatever, 90 by 90 feet. But they're smaller than most of these buildings come out to be. So we use that as an opportunity to literally take this and break it up in these little towers in a very rational, functional way, because this is a, you know, it's a Cal State, it's a Cal Poly building, needs to meet the budget, needs to work, all these different things. But it was an interesting way to do it differently than what people usually expected to do. And then what we liked is this idea of sort of inside, outside, something that makes sense for the users on the inside because it's very functional, it's interesting, and yet it's creating these interesting things on the exterior. And the atrium was also kind of a functional thing because we had these volumes, you know, we were filling up the site, and then there was this leftover space in the middle that then made sense to kind of leave it open, great for ventilation, quality of air, daylight, etc. But it's the heart of the building. And what's really nice about it, when you walk in it, it has an urban scale. And that's really important because the building has a nice urban scale as you walk around it. But then you walk in and it sort of feels like one, which again makes sense for the campus, how people move around it. And in this type of climate, it's great because you know, like people are constantly milling around, and people who are not in the building, just students, they go there to read, to take a nap or whatever, because it's a nice, nice place to be.
The thing, and we learned it when we did Baker, because the state gives you a net to gross efficiency, which allows you X number of square feet for corridors to make the thing work. And most of those big, long buildings, you get these corridors up the middle. And when we did the Baker building, they really wanted to have faculty and students have a place, and there was no space in the program to do that. We got creative and we said, we're not going to put corridors in if we don't have to, and we're going to combine all that space and make student space out of it instead of corridors. And I think that atrium that we've been able to achieve on this building, there's virtually no corridor space in the building. So while the net to gross has to meet the state requirements, they're getting that, but they're also getting this great space within the building to hang out in front of faculty offices, to hang out in between classes in that middle space. And it really, you know, it's really amazing that you get a building with the same net to gross, and yet it has all this space in it for students. And the goal was, and when we did Baker, the goal was to supplant the student union as the place for kids to hang out, which it did, you know, which was a problem for them because they thought it was going to be a 5 day a week, you know, 9 to 5 kind of space. And kids were sneaking in there and spending weekends and all that other time. This space is even better than that space. So I expect that this will supplant, you know, Baker and the union and the library as the coolest space to be, because you get to see science going on. You get to see other things happening in the space, which you don't get to see in a lot of these other buildings.
Architecturally, the Frost Center is a harmonious blend of brick, metal, and glass, creating a visually striking exterior that breaks down the massing into interconnected buildings.
We started off, and this came from the university, to use brick. And it's a nice brick. It's a Pereira, you know, the famous modernist architect from LA. He did a couple of buildings on campus, and it's this kind of reddish brick that, so we're like, okay, what are we going to do with that? So it was interesting because then gradually we start realizing the opportunities inside of this form. Because the first thing about breaking the volume, you know, it was just like little boxes and, you know, you work in the model. And then the realization was that the way these lab spaces work is that there's always one facade that needs more light to come in. And then it's almost like a bookend. There are two sides that are brick. And so that became like a kind of a simple idea that then allow us to take the form and really translate it into, again, reinforcing this idea of almost like individual little buildings, you know, like the Hilltown analogy. So that each lab neighborhood had these like two brick side walls. And then you had this kind of these metal panels that they were really optimizing both daylighting and views. You know, so that was nice because the scale was good. Also mixing materials, you know, the brick. And then the metal, my favorite thing about the metal is there's a eucalyptus tree that is the largest eucalyptus tree outside of Australia. Is that right?
Yeah.
Eucalyptus is very controversial, you know, but I like this tree. It's a beautiful tree. It's like this kind of light silver color, which is almost exactly the same as the metal. And it's really nice when you see this light and the metal and the shade. And then when you're on the inside of the building, that's what this really, you get the light coming through here. There was another thing about these lab buildings that's always, you know, no daylight, no connection to nature. So we were very cognizant that whatever we're doing on the exterior, it's really making this a better place, better building. And that's really nice. You're sitting there, you're having a cup of coffee. The light is very beautiful coming in. We have offices with operable windows, you know, which is, again, not very common, especially not for science buildings. So again, it's this idea of inside and outside, that it's not beautiful facade, but like don't look on the inside, but it's every point you're aware of this working from both sides.
Normally when you do a science building like this, the perimeter wall, everybody wants to put casework up against it. So you end up with either small windows or bigger windows with all kinds of junk up against the facade. And we pose the idea of turning the casework 90 degrees to the window. So you, from outside, you can see all the way through and vice versa. And there was a lot of resistance until we actually sat down and measured the linear footage of bench, you know, very analytically, that you could get. And they lost like less than 2 feet of bench space And so being able to prove it out, really, it's amazing the difference in these labs and the ones where the exterior wall is completely, you know, covered in casework. I mean, the interesting thing is most of the places where they're brick, the brick is cladding a concrete shear wall behind it. You know, so all the lateral for the building is done in concrete. In these neighborhoods, you kind of want to put it on those sides. So the locations of the brick are, I think, almost entirely where we have a concrete shear wall inside the building. So you're really going from concrete shear wall to building envelope, and it's pretty rigorous. So I think the detailing is pretty straightforward. It's really just a series of square boxes. I mean, you know, and they come together where the brick is, which is easier to deal with because it's typically a concrete wall back there.
You know, it's not an extraordinarily expensive building. It looks much more unique and bespoke. When you break it down, it's relatively simple. And we found different ways how to be creative inside of that sandbox of things that we could buy in a local market, et cetera.
It's essentially those fins are just expanded metal. It's a heavy gauge expanded metal. And then the other thing that was very interesting is there was a lot of fear with the shading, both the horizontal and the vertical, of birds. They have mud swallows, which build these mud kind of nests all over the campus, pigeons. And we had one guy who worked with a professor at Cal Poly and really spent a lot of time understanding, you know, the angle of repose to keep the birds from standing on it and the distance away from the glass. So a lot of the detailing that got put into the building was a response to, you know, keeping the birds from nesting there.
The character of the building is accentuated by a rhythmic repetition of exterior fins along the facade. These fins, strategically placed both vertically and horizontally, serve as a shading solution, allowing for expansive floor-to-ceiling windows in the laboratories. The orientation and size of the fins are optimized to enhance both daylighting and energy efficiency.
We had our, you know, the required value engineering sessions. And the interesting thing is if you take things like, those fins, they look really nice architecturally, blah, 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 blah. If you take the fins off the building, the mechanical system gets so much more expensive that you're going to spend more money than you are the way it is. And so, you know, the modeling that was done on those fins, they're not jewelry on the building. They actually really are working.
The way to design this is that, and you know, value engineering happens a lot. And so if it's purely aesthetic, someone can just take it and take it off. In this case, for example, you cannot take those screens off because your cooling and heating doesn't work anymore. So that means that seemingly aesthetic solution is integral to the performance of it. So like you walk around the building and there's a big concrete column and you say, oh, let's value engineer this concrete column. Well, you can't do it because if you take the column out, the whole building is going to collapse. So it's a little bit like here, like, no, you can't do it because that's good because it's something that's real. You know, we're not wasting money and it's much more integrated, especially for a science building. You know, science buildings should be about science, which looks good, but not fake.
If you actually look closely at the facades, we modeled not only for where, as the sun moves around the building, where you want the shading, but the Baker Center across the, you know, the walkway is a six-story building. And we modeled the shading from the adjacent building and from itself, the self-shading elements of the building where the building turns around. And you get less fins where you don't need them. So, you know, we essentially self-value engineered as a way to actually, you know, plan the thing. So it's actually really interesting. If now that you know that, next time you look at the building, you'll start to see, oh, there must be, you know, the other building shading it over there. They didn't need shading.
Stepping inside, the atmosphere is one of unparalleled connectedness and transparency. The vibrant green and gold hues of Cal Poly permeate the interior, accentuating the continuity between the indoor and outdoor environments.
The thing about these buildings that's really interesting, they're working buildings. They have that sort of workshop quality. And so part of it was for cost reasons, to make it simple and a little bit raw concrete, raw materials. But part of it is also the character of the building, that it's a studio. It's a place for science where we want to encourage people to be creative, be relaxed about what they do. And so we wanted to capture that, almost like a nice loft, kind of a workshop space. And in the end, that was great, because all these things that Ted just talked about sort of that came in together, because to achieve that sort of simplicity of the space, it took a lot of effort in terms of coordination, MEP, all these different things, which then led to a kind of a holistic approach to how we resolved the interiors. What we tried to do is to reduce the amount of applied finishes. If concrete is structure, let's leave that structure exposed. You can see in the images, the ceilings are exposed. And again, sounds obvious, but for a science building, not very common. More light, more air, nicer material. And then, okay, we have this concrete and, you know, it's California. It's bring some wood in there. You know, there's this reference now to modernism. So it's a building that's not fussy, that there's not a lot of stuff, things cladded and all that kind of stuff. There's something kind of light about it, casual, you know. And again, that feeds into these notions that more air, lightness.
The central atrium serves as the heart of the building, surrounded by tech-enabled classrooms, collaboration spaces, laboratories, and offices. The angular and dynamic architecture prioritizes sightlines, fostering a sense of togetherness and shared experience among users. However, the inception of this atrium turned a particular design challenge into a debate.
There was a moment where we had the faculty and the deans in a meeting, because that atrium, we wanted it open, and the faculty said, it's got to be enclosed. We need glass walls all the way around it, because the noise in there is going to be too loud and it's not going to work. And we told Phil it was really important, and he walked out of the room and went, there's the Frost Fund is a fund that Mr. Frost has given to the school for students to study Steins. And he went out and got some of the Frost students, who are some of the smartest kids in the school, bring them into this meeting. We're all sitting around. Their professors are sitting in the room. The deans of those professors are in the room. And he said, we're having a little debate here. Some people want us to enclose that and separate you all where you're going to sit from this atrium, and others want it open. What do you think? And the kids, to a kid, said, look, we want to hang out in this space because the action's here. We want to hear people. We want to be able to talk across the atrium. And if you put the glass in, we probably won't use the space. And Phil just smiled and said, I think we got our answer. You know, and it's having that kind of, I mean, it's just been so much fun to deal with him. The school is now named after him and his wife. His wife passed away during COVID. The school was renamed after him. So it's the Phil and Tina Bailey, you know, school, which they deserve. I mean, they have done so much for that school. But also Mr. Frost, who, there was a point where a lot of that wood was going to come out of the atrium and we couldn't afford it. And Phil took Mr. Frost into the atrium and said, look, we're going to have to take this wood out. And Mr. Frost said, no, you're not. And you know, between the two of them, they figured out how to get it paid for. But having an advocate for design on the client side just makes, whether the budget stays the same or not, it just makes it so much easier to do a really good building for somebody.
A two-level bridge spans the main campus north-south pedestrian axis, providing a dedicated space for flexible laboratory and computational work.
It's part of how the building works, because it's one building. So it happened that when we really tried to fit it on this site, one of the main walkways of the campus had to go through the building. So in a way, we just left out that piece that was sitting on the ground, effectively creating the two-level bridge. Is it a bridge? Is it a gateway? You know, it's more ambiguous, which kind of makes it nice. Instead of making it just circulation, you make it wider, just a little bit wider, so you can put some chairs and tables. So suddenly something that's just a corridor becomes a place for people to be. And it's really nice because it's kind of comfortable. It's not too big. It's not too small. And then most importantly, what's really important in these type of buildings is that when I'm on the ground walking by, I see activity in the building. you know, so that going back to this, like what not to do, science building, big, uninviting, cold, whatever, opposite of that, bridge, glass, transparency, and you see students relaxing. And these are not even students that are in, you know, work there. They're just there because it's a nice place to be and it makes the building inviting, more open, makes students want to come in and join them. So that's why the bridge is kind of really important, because it's stitching everything in a way together.
This funny shape of the building, you know, that spans over that walkway and has these pieces to it. Part of that was, as we were designing in schematic design, the president, Jeff Armstrong, came to us and said, I haven't raised all the money for the building yet. The deans haven't raised enough money to build the whole building. We can only build this $80 million piece, which was on the west side of that bridge. He said, how long, because we designed the whole thing, how long can I have to continue to raise money before we're done and I have to just say, this is all the building we can build? And we designed it so there's the piece with the atrium, there's the bridge and the first tower, which is chemistry labs, and then there's two more neighborhoods that head to the north, and said, we can design the whole thing and you can wait until you're ready to start construction, which gave them effectively about another 9 months to raise money. And so it was a $80 million, $100 million, or $120 million project, and just let us know before we start digging a hole which one we're going to do. And he was kind of amazed, and we were amazed he raised the whole amount of money by the end of before we started construction. So we got to build the whole building. Had we not gotten the money, that bridge would have been the logical place to just stop and say the other half of the, you know, that bridge is going to connect in the future as a second phase building. But just that kind of innovative way about thinking about how you design a building to allow the client to have the flexibility to continue to raise money was, you know, really valuable. We got a whole building.
And that's where the form helped, because going back to that Italian hill town, the organic form, you know, there are like, I don't know, seven of these boxes, five look good, seven look good. It gives you that flexibility. It's not a complete form.
Sustainability objectives were pursued through a reverse methodology, prioritizing practical and cost-effective solutions over certification compliance.
I mean, when we start thinking about sustainability, the last thing we want to talk about is what's our LEED certification, or are we going to get, you know, what are other certifications are we going after? We kind of flip it the other way and say, what's the right thing to do in terms of doing the most economical building, both to build, but to operate and maintain? And then when we get all done, let's see where we are. That's something we've kind of done on almost every project we're on. If I can build a business case for doing sustainability, it's just, you know, like the other conversations, you're not going to argue with me, because it's the best way to do it. And so by virtue of the space we had, that really set us up for some really, really interesting things. And the first one, San Luis Obispo is a fairly, you know, benign climate. It's getting a little hotter and hotter in the summers. All the original buildings on the campus were, you know, the faculty office building is the one that the faculty would point at every time we talked about operable windows. And because it has no shading on it, it faces due west. And in the afternoon, it's really hot and faculty can't really stay in their space. So we said, we're going to try to figure this out differently. The idea is all the faculty offices face north, and so they're getting incredible views too. But we gave them all operable windows. In addition, we put a fan in. Every faculty office has a ceiling fan in it, and there's a radiant panel in it for dealing with just water, no air. There's no air conditioning. We found if you give somebody an operable window, their thermal comfort range goes up and down automatically, just because they control their own space. And so the offices, they're not getting direct sun. They can open their window. The fan can go on above their head so they get some breeze, and that radiant panel can be used. That air gets cascaded into the atrium. There's a wood louver above those faculty offices. That air gets pulled into the atrium space and is really used for ventilating most of the atrium. And the reason that that's happening is because the lab side, which is 100% outside air, you can't recirculate air in a laboratory environment. And so we did it. We again worked backwards. We counted up the number of fume hoods we were able to accommodate in those lab spaces with a very, very high performance system, which relies on hydronics, water for heating and cooling, and provides only the 6 air changes that we need for health and safety in those labs. And what that does is it kind of quantifies how much air you have to bring into that space, because I'm sending 6 air changes out of that space. And rather than supplying all that to the labs, we're only providing a little or part of it to the labs. The rest of it, we're sucking through louvers from the office, from outside through the office, through the atrium into the labs. And effectively, I'm getting air conditioning for all those other spaces for free, because I need that air regardless for the lab. So really energy efficient. But the other thing is, it makes that atrium is 100% outside air. There's no recirculating air in that atrium. There's no recirculating air in the offices. So while it's really passive, it's a really healthy environment. After COVID, everybody was caring about that. It also happens to be a way better environment for learning in. I mean, if you don't have CO2 built up in a space, all of a sudden there's all kinds of studies that show your ability to focus goes up. So both from an energy perspective, but also from a health and performance perspective, we feel like it's a huge win for the university. And then there's heat recovery. So all that exhaust air, those 6 air changes that have to go out of the building, we're capturing the energy off of all of that before the air gets exhausted up, you know, into the sky, and that gets reused again too. So the lab is really a machine, but it's a machine that's operating way below where you'd expect it to be for a lab. And then water in California is the other big thing. But the entire site has a whole series of different ways of detaining the water on site and then getting it back down into the, you know, the water table rather than just pouring it out.
During construction, Ted and Vlad gained reassurance from an advocate who actively championed the integration of a new, contemporary building amidst the existing older structures on campus.
Rather than on construction, the whole process, and I'll step back, because when we started and when we did Baker, it was even worse. We had a couple that became believers, but the faculty had been in really 100-year-old buildings that were designed for other things and had been, they weren't great. And the faculty felt like they didn't really deserve a nice building. I mean, there's a lot of brutalist buildings on the campus that are brutal. And I went to school there, so I can say it. They were horrible to take classes in. And everybody felt like they didn't really deserve a good building, whether they could afford it or not. And so finding Phil Bailey, who was, you know, passionate about the students more than the faculty, he was passionate about the students. Finding somebody like that as an advocate, that when you say you could have it all, he was going to demand he got it all. And having somebody like that, that's an advocate that takes the project and owns the project. Things like, you know, there's the letters on the outside of the building, which is Latin for learn by doing. That was really important to him because he wanted a place for science students when they graduated to be able to get that picture with their parents. That space before the building was done is on the cover of every Cal Poly magazine that comes out, whether it's science or not now. And it was a small amount of money. It got VE'd out and Phil refused to give up on it. And so finding that advocate on a project is always so important, I think, to the success. So all the problems, does something not line up when you're pouring it? All those things, they kind of go away if you have an advocate on the client side that's demanding a good building.
I agree with that. You know, the in this case, person, Dean Bailey, he was there at every turn of this project. And that's critical because all these wonderful things that we talk about, they will not happen unless there's, you know, ultimately it's the client that needs to help us realize all of this or leads the realization of something like this.
The William and Linda Frost Center for Research and Innovation is more than a physical structure. It is a dynamic symbol of Cal Poly's commitment to shaping well-rounded, forward-thinking graduates. By breaking down disciplinary barriers, fostering collaboration, and providing state-of-the-art facilities, the Frost Center embodies the university's dedication to preparing students for the challenges and opportunities of the real world. I really enjoyed this conversation with Ted and Vlad. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
We've talked about this as all our partners in the firm. We've kind of focused it down on three things. And every project needs to somehow address these three things because it's our values. Hopefully the clients that are attracted and want to work with us have similar values. The first is that the buildings have to have an impact. And in a case like the Frost Building, the impact is how do I get students to get better grades, to do better, go on, become, you know, scientists, become engineers, astronauts. We have a few of those. How do I do a building that impacts people's lives in a positive way? The second thing is, and we started in the Northwest in the, you know, in the current partnership in the 60s, it's always been about sustainability and climate change. Every building we do has to address that in a big way. And then the third thing, which we've been talking probably 7-8 years now, is about justice and equity, not only for our own firm, but for the people that are occupying our buildings. And it's that point we made at the start. How do I get any kid on this campus who's afraid to be, you know, for, you know, they're the first kid in their family to go to college, whatever that issue is, that that building feels open and inviting and inclusive to them, and that they want to become, you know, they want to be a better person than they would have had they not experienced the building. And that's, for me, it's not world domination. It's just making the world a hell of a lot better place than it is before we got here.
You know, I agree with what Ted just said, that is really kind of the core of what we like to do. And, you know, combining education, combining science, it's just a very nice typology. You know, if you look at all the different buildings that architects can do, combining those things is just really nice. And you get to work with really cool people, like in this case, Dean Bailey, you know, on many researchers. You know, you look back and you're like, yeah, that was a, you got to pay the bills and do all of that. But that was really nice way to spend time. It's very fruitful. You know, it was fun, process of discovery. You look back, that's a very nice project, nice people we work with. And, you know, we think we made an impact. We made these kids experience better and more meaningful, etc. So maybe that sounds selfish, but it's, you know, it's not a bad way to get through the day.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.